Magic, in all its forms, has fascinated people throughout history. And we've touched on topics of magic before, even had our next guest on before to speak about this particular brand of magic, only to get derailed by the universe into talking about the peripherals around it. But the question was never truly answered. Just what is Thai Buddhist magic? Mm-hmm. And what's the correlation between it, trauma, and psychic abilities? Well, there is no one that I can think of that's better to shed some light on this fascinating topic than our friend, the Sadhu Da, who's back on the show for the second time. He's going to shed some light into that side of magic that the Western world just doesn't really get to see much of. My name is Will.
And I'm Karen.
And unlike Mulder and Scully,
we both want to believe.
So we've embarked on a journey of discovery.
We've talked to people deeply entrenched in the spiritual and metaphysical world.
We've thrown ourselves into weird and wonderful experiences. I even joined a coven of witches.
And wait, you joined a coven?
Yep, all in the interest of finding something.
Anything.
That will prove that there's something beyond this physical,
three-dimensional world we all live in.
This is the Skeptic Metaphysicians. Welcome to the Skeptic Metaphysicians. I'm Will.
And I'm Karen.
And if you haven't yet listened to our first interview with the incomparable Sadhu Da, I strongly suggest checking that out immediately following this one, because we're going to go in a different direction this time around. And I know you don't want to miss all of the information that our guest has so generously imparted already. Sadhu Da, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show once again. Welcome.
Thanks. Love being back here. That's a really good podcast that you got going.
Thank you.
Thank you for the kind words. We are having fun. That's for sure. We're learning a ton. And the more we learn, the more we realize how much there is yet to learn. So we're happy to have you on to help us in that arena. I'm just going to get right to it from the get-go. What is exactly Thai Buddhist magic?
What makes Thai Buddhist magic such a fascinating exploration of magic compared to like ceremonial magic and pagan practices and all these other cultures' versions of magic that we see all over the world is you have a combination of animism, so shamanistic type traditions, the old religion, as they say, mixed with Buddhism. And it blended together in the 14th century when Buddhism was essentially converting all of old Siam, which now we call Thailand. And you have these traditions that were very old that no matter how much you tried, you just couldn't stamp out. And so it blended in with the lore and the stories and the practices and everything that we know about Theravada Buddhism today, which is Thai Buddhism. And that's what makes it so unique.
Now, when you think of Thai Buddhist monks, you don't necessarily think of magic, right? You think of the chants and the meditations and all that kind of stuff. But you and Karen and I have had conversations before where we've gone into some in-depth examples of how Buddhist monks in Thailand actually use these energetic and animistic practices to make things happen. Mm-hmm. We'll get into that a little bit later because some of those specifics were mind-blowing when we first talked about it. But to get a little bit more about you, you are a student of Theravada lineage under Master Pong Sak. Is that right?
Yep.
You've had years of experience and training with inner door secrets of Thai Buddhist magic. You became a Mo-Fi in the Theravada tradition. And then you studied under Rinpoche and Lamas from the Bonpo Tibetan lineage. And you became a Lama, right, through initiation. You even became a high priest in a Wiccan coven. You studied under Jeffrey Duell in Norse magic. You became a master hypnotist. You are so multifaceted. You are familiar with so many types of magic. Why did you select Thai Buddhist magic to follow?
You know, for me, it's the one that I was never able to table. I had so much fun learning different Wiccan traditions and practices, and I still do blend and use some of that to this day in the things I do now. But I just kind of reached a certain point with quite a few traditions where this was nice, this was fun, I explored, I learned things, I got what I needed from it. With Thai Buddhist magic, I have not hit that cap, I have not hit that limit. There's still so much I'm still fascinated by. There's so much that I'm still learning. There's so much that I have a deep passion I cannot see leaving with that specific field of study.
Hmm. Well, before we get really, really into it, I do have a question. As Will was talking about all the things you've studied and the different, I don't know, titles you've obtained, I have not heard of a Mo-Fi. What is that?
So a Mo-Fi is a Thai tradition of shaman. So mofe. So this, you'll notice there's a lot of words like in the Thai traditions that there's like, how many ways do you want to say this? Ajahn. Yeah. So a mofi is simply the terminology for a Thai shaman.
Okay.
I'm looking at you now. And if you're only listening to the show, you're only getting half of the picture. So you should definitely check out our YouTube channel to see what the Sadhu Da actually looks like and how he expresses himself, because he has a lot of, he just did a whole Vanna White kind of da-da. So he's very expressive. His image, his look, the way he speaks, it really shares a lot of his knowledge, even without using the words. But I'm looking at you now and you don't look Thai to me. So how did you stumble on this modality? Wow, what called you to it?
Well, you are correct. I'm not Thai. I am African and Mexican, so pretty far from being Thai. But I stumbled on it when I first met Master Thanaful Phakdi, who then introduced me to Master Pongsak. So those were my two main masters in the Theravada tradition. And it was kind of this weird turning point in my life. I grew up with a lot of gang violence, drug addiction, things of that nature, at a very rocky childhood. And when I met Master Thanaful for the very first time, it was the first, I'd say, experience that I could really think of where I met somebody who wasn't scheming, trying to get one over on me, or wanted something from me. And that alone was really what intrigued me the most, was there was such thing as pure people in this world. Not saying that they only exist in Buddhism, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm saying within my experience, my background, where I came from, to that point in my life, this was the first time I met anybody like this. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of ultimately what got me to even go down that path.
What made you trust him and know that he wasn't pulling something over on you like the other people before?
You know how they say always trust your gut? Mm-hmm. I had that strong feeling that if I followed this man, if I listened to this man, that I would be safe, mm-hmm. that I would be okay, and that I would gain much more than I could possibly ever imagine. And that still stands to be true to this day.
And that really stems a lot from the reaction that he had to you, right? Because when the story that you shared with us off camera, it was astounding, where you have a certain look to you, and you mentioned you were involved with gang violence and things like that. Where how you grew up was a little rougher than a lot of the people that might be listening to the show. But you went into the temple, and where you expected these people to be afraid of you because of the way you looked and things like that. He actually reached out, right?
And yeah, there were people afraid of me. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I'm heavily tattooed and long, crazy hair, So I go to this temple just to like check this place out. I wasn't even seeking anything. It was more of, I grew up in Killeen, Texas. If anybody knows anything about Killeen, it is drive right through it.
don't stop.
Keep going.
Yeah.
You know anything about that town in Texas is that you don't want to know anything about that town in Texas.
Exactly. So like out in the county, where it was this Wat, and which is the name of a temple, is called a Wat. And so Wat, W-A-T.
Oh, yeah. That's Will for you.
I go there and I'm just looking around. There's beautiful sculptures. There's all this cool stuff that I have no experience with. I don't know what a Somdesh Bra is at that point. That's like the image of a Buddha, like stacked, I'll show you an example later, but it's a specific type of amulet, and there are larger styles of it. And so I'm seeing all these weird sights and things I've never seen before. And I always have loved art to some degree. And I thought this was just a really cool scenery. And these people just kind of like whispering and like walking around me, like with these like judgment looks on. And then this monk comes up to me and he starts explaining something to me about, the scenery, and telling me stories, and just very casually, like it's nothing. And I'm intrigued by it. And one of the things you'll notice in, Thai culture is that monks are like the Western equivalent of celebrities. Like they are very, very popular. If you see one out and about, you want to talk to them. You want that FaceTime. You want a picture with them. Like they're Thailand celebrities. And they kind of like this group of people had started to see me talking and having all this FaceTime with Master Thanafil. And so they come over and Master Thanafil's dismissive to them right away. He's like, no. You come to us. Like these people like went behind my back and like went to the monks and were saying like there's a scary looking man like skulking around the temple and he's got tattoos and like, you know, he might steal something and he looks dangerous. And, you know, Master Thanafil, rather than like, you know, come over and call me out or immediately be on guard, he just, you know, took the time to actually get to know me and talk to me. Mm-hmm. And he tells them, you know, I'm talking to this man who you thought was like, you know, scary and you were judging him for his tattoos and the way he looks. And he is a perfectly fine young man. There's nothing wrong with this young man. And, you know, because you were judging and because you wanted to act this way, you go and you talk to the other monks. I'm talking to this young man right now. And so like that was how me and Master Thanafil became friends.
So then he impressed you, which I can completely understand. But then what made you say, I want to continue down this path? Did they open up their secrets to you right away? Or did you have an initiation period? How does that work?
So there was a little bit of an initiation period, but it didn't take place until after I had kind of come back. There was the opening of that door, right? So I met Master Thanafil. I moved, I made new acquaintances. I got myself involved in the very first paranormal case I ever went on. I think I might have talked about this a little bit on your show, but I've told like the whole story before. So like, you know, this, that, and the other, a woman got possessed. I found myself in the middle of it. She was like crawling on the wall. Crazy stuff happened. I met a teacher.
Crawling on the wall, really?
Yeah. So, no. It's such a long story, but I met Master Amun at that point. And that was when I started to learn about magic and things of that nature. And then when I went back, that was when I met Charlita, who was the Coven Mother, and I started studying Wicca. And so I was like learning these two different forms of magic. And under Master Amun, there was a lot of other stuff he was teaching me at the same time too, like ceremonial magic. He was even teaching me like Qigong and things of that nature. Like I became like his apprentice right away because he saw something in me with the way I handled myself on that first paranormal case. Mm-hmm. And then once I had like come back and I'd met Master Thanafil again, that was like, he noticed something different in me. And so at that point, he explained that he wanted to teach me some things. And so for that to take place, I had to, one, go through this like weird period of like silence. And I had to do like Vipassana practices. I had to do these different breathing meditations, these walking meditations. And at first it was kind of like, I wasn't learning anything. It was more of just like following him around like a lost puppy. And he would just like, you know, instruct and say things and explain and then have me do stuff. But then shortly afterwards, he would just very casually show me something, you know, like a takrut, which is like a rolled piece of like, you know, copper foil with like Kom script or like Pali spell work on it. And then he would explain like how with each, you know, symbol and figure, how you point on this part as you're driving what's called like a mikru, like a Buddhist wand across it. And you're saying like, Namo Tassa, and like you're saying each syllable of this kata, mantra, and you're forming the symbol with the entire mantra at each point where it turns. And then he's like breaking this down into a complex science. And I was like, whoa, this is so cool. Like, what are we even doing? And then he explains to me once we make one, he's like, so now you know how to make takrut. He's like, this one for protection, this one helps stop bad dangers. And he explains that to me. And then he was like telling me, you know, never unroll a takrut because it releases the power from it. And it like will send back like the bad karmas that it chased away and the energies and things of that nature back onto you. Oh. And so like, yeah. So he was like explaining things in a way that not only gave me a deep and vast amount of knowledge on something that I already didn't know anything about to begin with, mm-hmm. but there were people who collect takruds and they're familiar with Thai amulets and things like this. And they don't even know about that stuff because that's like the inner door practice of it. Like that's how to make it, you know, you can learn a lot about cars, right? But that's different than knowing how to manufacture and build a car. Mm-hmm.
All right.
So it was kind of the same thing. And before I realized it, I was being invited to all kinds of different things. And some of the journeys that me and Master Thanafil went on were kind of like pilgrimages that I don't necessarily talk about because there's a certain level of secrecy within some of the traditions.
Sure.
And some of the ways that you're taught things, and to hold the purity of the lineage, those things just can't be made public.
Right.
But they changed my life forever and what I thought was possible. And I guess one of the wildest things that I experienced with Master Thanaful was like having these profound experiences that defied logic, that defied reason, and yet he could explain them. You know, like I told you the story about the monk with the water coming out of the hands and things like that.
Yep.
You know, and it's like it defies logic, but then you're explained through this canon of knowledge and how these practices are formed and the way that's attained, and understanding like, you know, these complex witcha, these magical systems of practice that come from, you know, the Theravada traditions. And you're like, okay, well, that does make sense. But at first it's just magic until you explain it in a scientific way.
Hmm. You're kind of speaking my language in a way. We're talking a lot about Thai Buddhist magic, and we're talking about ceremonial magic and all kinds of different magic, but that's magic with a CK. But there's got to be a way to explain what some of these things are doing. Or is it truly just these magical shadow figures that make shit happen?
Oh, you're going to love this. You're going to love this. So I have this, let's see, article that I wrote, and I'll just give you like the cliff notes of it. And this is an explanation that you're looking for.
Okay.
This is basically what you're asking about is like, how can we bring the science to magic? So this one, I titled it Scientific Foundations of Magic. And many people often wonder where magic ends and science begins and vice versa, right? Mm-hmm. The two are not exclusively separate. Many a time, someone made the comment that magic is just a technology we don't fully understand yet. So understanding that little tidbit, let's get straight into it. So there's a couple experiments that we want to be aware of. One, Vladimir Poponin is the owner of Nanophotonics Biosciences, Inc., he's also a highly respected quantum physicist known worldwide for his contributions in quantum biology. He has established a vast amount of research into the nonlinear dynamics of DNA and the interactions of weak electromagnetic fields with biological systems. Okay, so not magic, science, right?
Quantum mechanics.
Yes. He conducted an experiment in the early 90s and demonstrated human DNA can affect the photons around it. This means that human DNA can affect light particles. E equals MC squared. The famous equation that Einstein discovered tells us, in combination with Poponin's research, that all matter is composed of light and can be manipulated by other light particles. In his experiment, Poponin had a glass tube with all the air removed to create a vacuum, and all that remained were photons, light particles. And then he went on to measure the distribution of the photon particles in the tube while in a vacuum state. Poponin validated the distribution of the photon particles was entirely random. He then introduced human DNA inside the tube. Only this time, when the photons were measured, there was a pattern present, meaning the photons were aligning and positioning according to the presence of human DNA. They actually aligned along the axis of the DNA. This would indicate in some way that the photons had to have been aware of the introduction of the human DNA. Removing the DNA from the tube presented interesting results as well. The photons didn't return to behaving randomly. They behaved as if the DNA was still present in the tube. The photons maintained the aligned structure of the DNA, which means the DNA must have left an energetic imprint once removed. This phantom DNA energy field was continually observed and kept the photons in place for a month. Interesting when you think about lunar cycles and et cetera, but that's for another day. So right. What does this mean though, right? Like, okay, so you just told us about this cool science experiment, but like, where's the magic? I don't understand the magic, Sadhu Da. But wait, there's more. When we talk about chi, prana, mana, energy, and the chakras and meridians, we're talking about a complex energy body that fuels the physical body. The result of Poponin's experiment tells us that we have an energy body capable of existing and operating outside of the limits of physical containment. When the human DNA was removed in the experiment, the photons remained in communication with the DNA. This means physical matter can be absent and a bioenergetic connection can still be maintained because it's working with the greater energy field with which all matter is connected to. Using this knowledge, we can explain residual hauntings, the imprint of energy on a land that turns sour, holy spots all over the world, and why some people can sense a presence without being able to see it. Ghosts are even worth mentioning here. Ghosts are composed of energy, and that is why they can interact with energy fields of other living beings and physical matter. They are manipulating the photons within a specified field to create a specific effect, which seems otherworldly, but they are merely following the laws of physics and the principles of energetic exchange. If enough energy is condensed, those photons become more visible, and this explains why we can see manifestations of ghosts sometimes. We can also note that phantom DNA staying in place for a month lines up with that monthly lunar cycle I was talking about, and this is how in some magical practices of amulet and talisman crafting, energies are consecrated and laid on top of one another to induce a specific effect, which is just the amulet or talisman resonating with specific or wider fields of influence to achieve the determined effect for the person holding or within reach of the harmonized energies, who then joins their energetic field to this constructed field of energy. It's not crazy magic. It's literally science.
So what you're saying is that you don't practice Thai Buddhist magic. You practice Thai Buddhist quantum mechanics.
Yeah, yeah, but that doesn't roll off the tongue. Doesn't sound as cool.
It sounds like that's true.
Yeah. Like edgy and boring, kind of.
I agree. Now, last time you were here, we talked about some of the really interesting esoteric things that Thai Buddhist monks use for their practices.
Yeah. Babies.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh yeah, the gumentong.
Yes.
All that stuff.
All that kind of crazy stuff that you told us about, that you know, I need to make sure that we get out there, because some of that stuff made Karen and I look at each other like, what are we listening to? What are we hearing? So can you share a couple of those with us that really kind of makes your hair stand up on end?
So what's interesting to me is that, you know, Western culture has just such a hang up on death and find it to be taboo. And we do everything we can to push it away from our scope of everyday life because it's just not right for some reason. Just have an aversion.
It's death. Right. It's the end of everything. Or is it?
It's just part of a cycle. It's part of a yuga, like the Hindus talk about. You know, it's a Kali Yuga is the ending of a cycle. And for there to be, you know, so Kali and Shiva are often depicted together. And what that is, so for the end of something, for the death of something, for something to be reborn or to be born, there has to be a destruction. So when a body decays and that energy is being gathered up by a spirit, right? It'll gather its prana, its energy, within 3 days after the person has died. There's still prana, there's still energy in this body. And depending upon the situation and the circumstances, I mean, some of these witcha are so complex. I mean, you can study this stuff for years and still learn very little about it. Certain things like a person, you know, who dies like a violent death, like suicide, murder, etc. They're perfect material. And I don't say that in a demeaning way. I mean, this is like, you have to take the emotion out of this and look at this as like a practice and a science and an exploration into human consciousness and what we're achieving with these energetic fields and mixing, like I talked about. So you'll find that there's perfect materials, like whether that be a female who died on a Saturday and she was also born on a Saturday. And then like that goes into like a very specific type of like amulet and things you can make with the material of the hair, the skin, the bone, chinatan, as it's called, and these spirit statues that you make known as prai. So it's not just straight necromancy and black magic, as a lot of people might just jump to the conclusion of, because what you're doing is you're entering into a contract with the spirit, as the Ajarn, the Mofai, such as myself. When we gather the materials like this, we are giving that spirit the ability to right a wrong within their own existence and to work off some negative karmas, to accumulate good merits, to share in the good deeds of our life, or the owner who will buy and own the statue and work with it. They don't use the term buy, though. They say rent. You're renting an amulet. It's just a little thing, but that is a thing in the culture. So what happens is this spirit will then gain good merits and good deeds that go into its karmic bank. so that when it eventually crosses over, it gets a higher reincarnation than it would have originally had. So this isn't like a spiritual slavery type situation. This isn't a harvesting, you know, material of dead bodies, you know, for some grotesque shock factor. This is a very, very normal part of Thai culture. It's very normal. People aren't weirded out by it. And when you talk about like the Kuomintang, the roasting of child corpses, like people are immediately like, say what? You know,
but yes, we did.
you're looking at the potentiality of this child who's already dead, right? So, you know, unfortunate circumstance. It's a very sad thing when a child dies, but you have the ability here to do something very powerful, something very positive. And that's where I kind of like, you know, I'm like trying to reshape the way the Western mind kinds of thinks about this thing, because I get people who practice like forms of black magic, if you will, and they'll kind of come to me and they're like, I'm interested in your necromancy and this and that. And I'm like, you're coming to me for the wrong reasons. And that's not really what I do. We're both very different in our intentions with the subject of death, and I'll kind of send them on their way. But with the Kuomintang, you have a child who has the potential of an entire lifetime that was just snuffed out. All of that energy, all of those experiences that could have been, that should have been, that don't happen. And then this limbo state and being reborn again takes so long. Master Thanaful sat down and like broke into pieces different aspects of like human consciousness and the way it evolves and how it develops, which is just so crazy that like they have these scripts and they have all these things that, like, and this has been, you know, part of their history for hundreds and hundreds of years. And like, let's just pass it down like it's nothing. And I'm like, whoa, like I've never thought about this before. Like, this is crazy. And he explained to me that like when you take that child and you nurture it and you raise it, you know, its spirit, and you help it evolve and grow, and then you give it these good merits, and it gets very powerful, and it'll help you with like manifestation, with ritual work, with like, you know, affairs of love and charm, business, getting good jobs, promotions, like gambling, all kinds of things that people use these for. And in return for the spirit helping you, you're helping it to have a better reincarnation and to evolve and grow. It's a very symbiotic situation.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more amazing conversation on the Skeptic Metaphysicians.
And now back to the Skeptic Metaphysicians.
So when you're collecting these materials, is it like, okay, so here, you know, in the States, you have your driver's license and you say that you're an organ donor, and that's kind of giving permission. If something happens to you, they can, you know, harvest your organs. Is it something where everyone in that belief system automatically feels that way or believes that way or gives that permission, or is it specific to, you know, this person and their family? How does that work?
Right, because you're talking, because we didn't go into as much detail this time as we did the first time around, but you are talking about actually roasting the dead body of a child that passed away.
So that practice has been made illegal in Thailand for a variety of reasons, which should be obvious, right?
Yes.
But now
found on roasting babies. Yeah.
So now what they'll do is they'll take the cremated ashes of the child. So if the family has them cremated, or if the child is buried, they'll have like a ceremony, like Wai Kru and things like that, where they'll call forth the spirit of the child, and they'll use other like prai material, usually children's ashes. And like they'll put it into the statue, and then and like the statue will be made from like a clay or something like that. And that'll contain the spirit of the child. That'll be the Kuomintang or the Luk Tep or the Luk Krak, which are like different variations, which is like a whole nother subject, but essentially just child spirit to keep it simple for right now. And what you'll find is that it's very complex. There are aspects where it's done in a positive intentioned way. Like, for example, I have this Pry amulet right here. So, oh, here it is. So this young lady, this is her actual picture. Ajarn Masia made this, and it has like her blood in a vial. It has bone from her body, funeral shroud. It has like actual material from this woman. Now the family, once the woman, you know, passed away, she was a sex worker, and she was found brutally beaten to death in an alley. It was a very, very tragic death. You know, it's very sad. Like, mm-hmm. In no way, shape, or form does anyone deserve that. And so the family, they wanted something good to come from this. They wanted you know, her death to not be like this meaningless, like violent end. They wanted her to be able to do some good in the world with such a bad and unfortunate, you know, incident. And when you think about that, that's actually a very sweet intention, you know, move on the parents' part. Mm-hmm. Like they're grieving. Like it's not just like, yeah, like let's make some money, chop up our dead daughter. That's not what it is at all. Like these are grieving parents who truly loved their daughter, and they have chosen to seek out the spiritual teacher to then use parts of her body to make amulets to help other people so that their daughter can have good merits built up, so their daughter can have a better reincarnation where maybe she won't be bludgeoned to death in an alleyway again in her next life. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. If that doesn't touch your heart, I think you're a monster. Like, you know, that's a beautiful story mm-hmm. from such a tragic ending. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the aspect of how this can be positive intention. Same with parents that, that lose their child and they still want to raise that child, even though that's just not possible anymore. So they have their child turn into a Gumenthong and then they care for it as a child, because that's how you treat a Gumenthong spirit. You give it toys, you talk to it like a baby, like, you know, you take care of it. And so it's become ingrained in the culture that death isn't this big, scary, bad thing. Death is just part of life. You can't be here without dying eventually. It's just mm-hmm. part of the package. And where it gets to be questionable sometimes in the culture is you'll have police officers that want to make money. And it's kind of common knowledge. The Thai police force is very corrupt in many ways. And so what they'll do is they have like a network of buyers that they'll contact when they come to a suicide scene. And they'll say like, you know, we have this, this man that was found in a bathtub, you know, days later. And like, he's like, his body is like kind of started to liquefy in the water. You know, we collected this much from the crime scene of this like liquefied fat and water, and, you know, highest bidder gets this. And then, so the people will like, and they'll take pictures of it. So it's like, it, you know, it's legit. Like it literally came from what they said it came from. And then these people will buy the material. And then they'll take it to like the monks, they'll take it to the Ajarn, they'll take it to these holy men, and then they'll have them crafted into amulets. And then a lot of those proceeds will usually go to like foundations that help like, you know, people with like diseases that don't have healthcare or access to it, feeding them, putting kids through school, rebuilding temples, all kinds of things. So there's a lot of good that comes from it, even though there is like this underworld crime aspect of it taking place. And then you have like hospitals that'll, instead of disposing of the babies, like they'll take them to temples. And there was like one temple that got in a lot of trouble for that because it got busted and caught. But like, there's different levels of it. Like there's people who do it with positive intentions, and there's people who do it to make money.
Right. And it's all about the intention, right? So does it sour the magic then if it's done in an intentionally inappropriate way? Does it sour the energies that are mixed in with it?
Yes, but that's not the final say so. There's ways to purify death energy, and there's ways to kind of remove the elements of backfire. Ajarn Pui talks about it quite a bit. So he's often known as like, you know, the professor of necromancy. He's a famous shaman in Thailand who is like commonly sleeps in graveyards. And I mean, the man is just like surrounded by death all the time. And like, that's just his jam. And people will collect his picture because it's said that just having a picture of Ajarn Pui scares away bad ghosts. So like, this man's held with a lot of like respect and esteem. And what he'll often do is he'll have people that will bring prize statues or like Gumenthong that might've been made in an unethical way to him, and he'll purify them. Mm-hmm. And for a small fee, of course.
Of course.
He'll purify them and give them back to the people. And so there are certain secrecies behind like how that's conducted and done. But usually, you know, without saying too much, there's kind of like a trading of your own life force in that aspect. Mm-hmm. So one can only do that for so long before it catches up. There have been some famous Ajarns who played with too much Namen Prai oil, which is like chin fat oil melted from a corpse. And it makes people like lust after you like crazy. And so there was this one Ajarn who used it on all kinds of like young ladies, and like they went so crazy jealous over him that they ended up murdering him. It was wild. Like at first it was like, dang, like he's like getting all these women and this and that. And then next thing you know, like they lost their minds. And also there's the aspect of like ghost sickness where like ingesting the Namen Prai oil can give you really strong spirit power, but you're also eating literal death energy And so it'll start to corrupt you internally. And with ghost sickness, the ghost eat you from within. So like you'll lose your mind. Your organs can shut down. You can have like a wasting away kind of. And it's a really, really terrible thing to watch. I've had a couple people that I had to cure of ghost sickness. And it was really interesting because medically, you know, they're experiencing all these ailments and these things going on. But doctors are like, we don't understand. Like tests are coming back negative. Like you should be fine. But like you're bleeding from your bowels and we don't know how to explain it. Or like, you know, like you say that you can't eat. We've given you nausea medicine. And yet you're like, keep losing weight because the ghosts are eating you from within. Or they end up in a mental institution. They just mentally just shatter. Crazy stuff.
How do you cure someone from that?
So what I do is I use a process from Corandismo where I use lumpia. So I use like an egg and I'll like draw like the sickness into the egg, and I use iron to separate the attachment from the spirit, pressing it onto the skin. And then I'll actually go through their entire like energetic body and clear it with the like, with kata. Like I'll use like Atsapitsulopusapupa. It's like very powerful, calls on like a bunch of lineage masters, and I'll use that one and I'll just like run it through, and I'll just kind of like, it's like running something through the washing machine a couple of times till it comes out clean. And so like I'll do that like repetitiously and just kind of roll through that. And then sometimes like I'll prepare like a luk om, which is like this little clay ball, and it'll have like blessed lucky rice and like certain charged spiritual herbs, things that have like sat on the altar for several months, including like even a couple years. And then I'll put this like mixture together and I'll have them ingest that. And then I give them like blessed water that like I'll use like a mitmore or a micru and like some kata chanting into the water, and then like special sea salt, mix that in, and then take some of like when you chant and you get the consecrated chants, you get a lot of power. And this is like underneath your tongue is the purest chi condensed in your body through your meridian system. And so I'll take like a dab of that, and then I'll put that into the water. And so it's like, some people might be like, ew, they're drinking your spit. And it's like, no, they're actually like ingesting very condensed pure chi. But if you want to just focus on its spit, like, okay, we can do that. But drink it because it's good for you.
Wow.
What I'm hearing you say is that this stuff is not for the weak of heart, right? This is not something you go into unknowingly. If you want to get involved with this kind of thing, you need to make sure you have someone's strong guidance, because at every step of the way, you talked about, like, don't unroll the thingamajigger, right? Like, who knew that I could get all that stuff that I just put out in the universe back at me? Or who knew I shouldn't use chin fat of a corpse if I didn't know what I was doing, you know? I mean, it doesn't come naturally to me. I would just do it and then see what happens. But if someone wanted to get involved, wanted to learn more about Thai Buddhist magic, how could someone do that? I mean, because there are not a lot of Thai Buddhist monks in Virginia, for example.
You'd have to contact someone like me, unless you know someone like Master Thanaphol or Master Pongsok or Lone Porkok or like any of these like masters, Ajahn Pui, AJ Macia, all these people. Like, unless you know them or you know someone like them, then like, sorry, but you don't have access. And I mean, good luck if you try to figure it out on your own. These are very complex magical systems.
Yeah. Very dangerous. Yeah. It could potentially dangerous magical systems you don't want to stumble into.
Well, it's like even something like gathering Gopal. Gopal is like, it's like, oh gosh, this stuff is like really, really freaking potent, and it's useful in a lot of like Sunye Metta, like charming magic. And Gopal is the running musk oil from the back of a mating elephant's ears. And so to gather that, when's the most dangerous? I mean, elephants are dangerous, right? But when's an elephant the most dangerous? During mating season.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so no one likes to be interrupted in that moment. I'm sorry. It doesn't matter if you're an elephant or a human being.
I want to know who figured that out the first time. Like, hey. So
this is like the secret life of monks that like cracks me up, because like everyone has this picture of like, you know, this monk, you know, in silent meditation, like just so you see those inspirational calendars and all that. And it's like, my image is like this monk standing in front of a charging elephant, like chanting kata feverishly to like subdue and calm the mental fortitude, and like essentially kind of hijack the mind of the elephant, and then get the elephant to allow him to climb on top of the elephant and scoop up some of the oil from behind its ear. Wait, that's my idea of a monk. That's what I think of.
That's
how you get it.
That actually happens.
That is how you get Gopal. And many people who
out of a tree, land on him.
Well, you have to be taught the proper kata, because the proper kata, when you learn it, it has this calming effect where you actually like pacify the elephant, where you can actually get it to a pacified state where you can go up and you can gather. But many people have just like, they know Gapao is actually very expensive too, rightfully so.
Right.
And there are people who are not trained in it or like try to figure it out on their own. And then what happens? They get trampled to death by a freaking elephant. Like, go figure.
Wow. Yeah.
And these kinds of things, you can't just find them in your local grocery store, right? You mean these are,
no.
You got to go to a specific place for this. Is it usually mostly just sold in Thailand or can this stuff be found elsewhere?
You got to think about the culture, right? So that's where you're going to find it. But you have like people like me that have, connections with temples in Thailand, who have connections with various different monks. And I regularly have like a bunch of stuff like sent to me and on like a revolving basis. Like, I'm like, hey, like when y'all get new Kaplicin is in, let me know. Like that stuff's selling hot right now. So it's like, yeah, it's like, why would you want Kaplicin to Sayadaw? And I'm like, for wealth, you know, like formula and like spells, duh. Like everybody knows Kaplicin is for that.
No. So,
like, which is like, you know, like that's what these are. So that's cat placenta.
It's not a word you hear about very often or think about very often.
And if you're not watching this, you're only listening, it's like an amulet. It's not like a big old slab of something you just pulled off the shelf.
Right.
It's nice and tidy.
Yeah. Do yourself a favor and go check out our YouTube video so that you can see exactly what the Sayadaw is holding up right now, because otherwise the image in your mind is probably not going to be a pleasant one.
No. I want to know one thing, and it's a little bit of a different topic, but you know, you hear about Christianity and
you're changing the topic from the cool stuff.
No, this is something I've been wondering and I need to know. And so, you know, you get baptized in this. If you're not baptized, you're not going to go to heaven and all this stuff. And this is the one religion and the, you know, there's the Muslim, like everybody has their one religion. So for someone like you who practices this, where do other belief systems fall into play? Are they just wrong or is there a little, like how, what are your thoughts on that?
That's, you know, honestly, that's not for me to determine for anyone else. For myself, I'm aware of certain elements of how the spirit moves within the spiritual realm. Mm-hmm. And if I were to play my cards right, I think it's safe to say that I could expect a certain type of result based upon how I choose to live my life. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I go about it is, you know, if I help people, if I try to do good things, if I live my life in an honest way, then when I pass and I have, you know, a proper ceremony or my spiritual energies condensed to go within a certain place, maybe I can enter one of the heavenly type of realms, which is basically just a higher vibratory plane. I think heavenly or heaven is just too highly charged of a word and gives people specific imagery. Mm-hmm. And it's not even necessarily anything like that. So like, I think I stand a pretty good chance of going to a higher vibratory plane of existence, or at least coming back into an ideal life like this one has been for most of my adult life. My childhood was not that great, but I would say as an adult and in my past experiences this last decade, especially, life's been pretty good for the most part. And I don't really have any complaints and I'm pretty satisfied and content as things stand right now. So if I get another experience like this, I'd say I'd be okay with that. But for me to determine what anyone else is going to get or have, that's not my place to say. I have thoughts. I have, you know, theories and I have some education that would lead me to believe certain things, but it's not for me to pollute the mind of another.
Okay. That's fair. And I, for me personally, I think that everybody has their path and they choose what, you know, what is right for them. And I'm kind of be a good person, put the good energy out there and you'll go to the good place, whatever that is for you.
It was a good show.
You'll be on TV. No, but I just know that some religions are like, my way or the highway. So I just didn't know if that was a belief system of the like people that practice Thai Buddhist magic, if they think that's the only way or if they give room for other people in their belief systems as well.
Yeah, I mean, really the way it's approached in Buddhism is they don't believe in a god, you know. They believe that the Buddha has shown the way to liberate yourself. So Buddha isn't worshipped as a god. Buddha is worshipped because his mercy in going forth and struggling, because before then there was two extreme paths, right? There was the path of bliss and there was the path of pain. And either one of those could bring you to enlightenment or kill you while you tried. And the Buddha found the middle way, right? And so it's an amazing thing because he taught us, like, you know, a salvation for ourselves. Whereas, like, in a lot of other religions and practices, like, you know, there's some sort of being that gives you salvation. And a lot of people will kind of, without a proper understanding, make that same association about Buddha. But the Buddha is more of like, hey, this is possible. I was literally just a regular human. And I put, you know, my effort, my energy, my soul, everything in existence into striving towards enlightenment. You can do it. I have shown it's possible. And so that's what it's really about, is that you can redeem yourself. You can break those karmic chains. You can transcend. It's possible. Now, what you want to do is up to you.
And there's a school of thought that says the Buddha, Jesus, all these different religious leaders, for lack of a better word, may not necessarily have been, like, Jesus may not have been the true reincarnation of God on the planet, for example, but rather an ascended master that was teaching us the way to ascend, to move forward. Same thing can be said about the Buddha. Same thing can be said about Krishna, all these different entities that are meant to come down and help us to pave the way. So I get what you're saying. The question that stays in my mind, though, is some of the stuff that you were just talking about that they do. And I want to note the fact that you, when you refer to Buddhists, you say they. Do you not consider yourself a Buddhist?
No, I don't really consider myself anything. Note that I mentioned how much I love and am drawn to this practice and how it's a very big part of my life, but I never said I am a Buddhist. It is useful for me. There's a lot that I learn from it as far as what I believe, like spiritually. Like, I don't necessarily have a religion. Like, I don't want to sound hokey, but, like, you know, the Dalai Lama said, like, you know, my religion is love. Like, that's very much so how I feel. It's like, you know, everything's relevant to me in some way at some point and maybe some time. I play in the parameters of whatever is appropriate for the situation. When I have clients or students that are Christian and they want to take that path working and they're coming to me, like, I will use Christian mythology. I will teach them certain prayers, like the Anabagoic prayer. I will show them, you know, like a path working within that, right? But that doesn't mean that's what I follow either. It's just that the Thai Buddhism is my go-to. It's what I'm most comfortable with. Sure. But that doesn't mean I have to be a Buddhist.
And that goes to your question, Karen.
No, that's what I love. Yeah. That's perfect.
Yeah. You take little bits and pieces of all different things and you create your own modality that makes sense to you. That makes perfect sense for the both of us.
And that's what we've done.
No, exactly. I can't believe I'm about to say this, but do you realize how much time we've actually spent already speaking? And I have so many more questions. I have such a fun time talking with you. I don't want to let you go. I mean, it's,
placenta.
it's important to follow up on the fact that all this stuff is used for the greater good, right? It's not, yeah. I mean, you hear of people that use these types of things for nefarious purposes and things like that. But for by and large, the Thai Buddhist monks that use these magics, they use them for the greater good of humanity of itself, right? It's not meant to be looked at as something evil or negative in any way, right?
And it's not meant to be used that way either. A lot of monks will actually encode certain spells, kind of like a tamper-proof lock, like spiritually inside of it, to where if you try to misuse it or abuse it for something very negative, it backfires on you.
Oh, wow. I like that.
That's like the rule of three in Wicca, right?
Yeah. Don't mess with Buddhist magic.
That's just a rule of law. Wow. Well, we have so much more to talk about, Sadhu Da. I just can't believe we're already over almost to an hour in this interview. I cannot thank you enough for coming on and fighting all the gremlins and for the casual listener, this is not the first or the second time that we've tried doing this recording. We actually, last time we tried doing this, it was catastrophic. We lost the files because it, for some reason, something didn't want us to get the stuff across. So we're trying different platforms just to get this messaging out, because I know Karen and I love talking to you. So we're going to keep our fingers crossed. And when we hit end broadcast, everything's been recorded correctly. Sadhu Da, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think we may need to find some time to do a part three, because I don't think we're close to coming to the end of this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I welcome that. You know, there's God, there's just so many things we haven't even really gotten to talk about.
I know.
That we intended to the very first time.
And besides being so informative, you are just, so, we would be friends. Like, you're just this great guy, you know, and so personable and so much fun to talk to. So we, besides the subject matter, really enjoyed our talks with you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I feel the same way. I like to smile, have a good time, and just live, man. Life is a great thing.
Yeah,
it is.
That's exactly how we are as well. So once again, thanks for coming on, and we'll see you again on part three.
Sounds good.
And Karen, before we wrap this up, I wanted to share with you the fact that we got another 5-star review.
Woo-hoo.
Yep. This one's from Jocelyn. She says that this show is definitely in her pod rotation. She says she learned something new every single episode, and it's always something different and interesting that maybe she never knew about or even heard about before. Case in point, Thai Buddhist magic.
Well, that's our goal, right?
It absolutely is. She goes on to say that this podcast makes you feel like your journey for answers, whatever you're looking for, it makes her feel like she's not alone in her search. So that's perfect. Jocelyn, thank you so much for leaving that review. And we'd love to hear from you. So visit us at skepticmetaphysician.com, where you can leave us a voicemail or an email directly. You might just hear your voice or your words on the show if you do. And we're always looking for ways to improve. So if you have some feedback that you'd like to provide, good or bad, you can do that directly on our website as well. Remember that reviews and ratings are a great way to evolve and grow the show. So we'd love it if you would take a minute and do that if you can. Well, we hope that you've enjoyed this episode as much as we have. That's all for now. We'll see you on the next episode of The Skeptic Metaphysicians. Until then, take care.